So in addition to the prohibition of not eating or benefiting from chametz over Passover, there's a different prohibition in the Torah. The Torah says, lo yira'e lecha chametz, velo yimatzeh. And the chametz shall not be seen or found in your possession on Passover. According to our oral tradition, we're not banned from looking at chametz. We're banned from owning chametz. We're not allowed to own chametz over Passover. Chametz is anything that is made from one of five grains, wheat, barley, oats, rye, or spelt, and has fermented in any way. Now, these flours or grains ferment fairly quickly. So if it's been made into anything, virtually anything, and has not, other than matzah, where it was specially kept to make sure it doesn't ferment, it would be considered chametz. So anything that you buy that has one of those grains, including something that has malt in it, wood malt is often from those grains, would be considered chametz. So we are prohibited not just not to eat it, but not to own it over Passover. We're not allowed to have it in our possessions. We're not allowed to own it. In addition to the prohibition of not owning chametz on Passover, if a Jew did own chametz on Passover, and then after Passover ends, it's forbidden to eat it forever. It's called chametz sha'avar alav ha-pesach. Chametz that was owned by a Jew on Passover is banned. We're never allowed to eat it. So, to avoid owning chametz on Passover, the Torah requires us to destroy any chametz in our possession before midday on the day before Passover. So on the eve of Passover, from midday on, we're already not allowed to eat our own chametz. The Torah says before that, you have to destroy all chametz in your possession. That's a command. Destroy. The way we destroy it is by burning it. We burn our chametz, and we do that on Monday morning. We have a custom. We take some chametz, and we burn it to fulfill the mitzvah of destroying chametz before Passover. Now, while the Torah says not to do it from midday, on the day before Passover, not to own chametz, and to destroy the chametz before midday, on the day before Passover, our sages extended that just a little bit, by an hour, and they said, destroy your chametz an hour before midday, in order that you don't miss the time by accident, because you were going too slow, or you didn't notice the time, so you don't accidentally miss the time, and you don't come close to transgress the prohibition of owning chametz on Passover. They said you should burn it more than an hour before midday. And already an hour before midday, we should not own any chametz. So before that, in order not to own any chametz, our sages said on the eve before Passover, that would be Sunday night this year, we should search for chametz all over our house. We should do a search right after dark, and we should look for chametz all over our house. We'll talk about it more next Sunday, the search, and how it's done. But we look throughout our house to see if we can find any chametz. Even before that, before the eve before Passover, before the search, our sages say that one should clean through their entire house in the days, weeks leading up to Passover to make sure that there is no chametz anywhere in the house. You don't know where someone may have placed chametz. There may be places where there are chametz. If you know that you never bring chametz into a particular room, you don't need to clean and search that room. But if you sometimes do eat in that room and you may have accidentally brought chametz, or maybe if you have children, the children may have done so, you must search that room and clean it for chametz beforehand, and you must search it on the eve before Passover. And just in case you did miss something, there is chametz somewhere hiding in your house that you do not know about. What we do is, on the day before Passover, when we burn our chametz, we also make a declaration that we say all chametz that may be in our possession that we don't know about, or maybe that we knew about and we forgot, is all ownerless. We remove any ownership we have from that chametz. It's not mine anymore. So even if it's there lying somewhere in my house, it's not mine anymore. So that way I do not own any chametz on Passover.
What about like your car? Like if you don't eat in your car,
If you never eat in your car, you don't need to check your car. I don't know too many people like that. I'm sure there are some. If you do eat in your car, then you absolutely need to clean your car before Passover, and you need to check your car for chametz before Passover.
But you can put groceries in your car.
My new car.
Well, the groceries, hopefully, you always take out of your car. They don't get lost in there. But most people eat in their car, so it's still a problem. What happens if a Jew has chametz that they don't want to get rid of? They have a cake, they have a bottle of whiskey that they don't want to get rid of, they don't want to eat before Passover, they can't drink that much before Passover, they're saving it for something, they want to have it after Passover. So what do? You're not allowed to own any chametz on Passover. So in a book called the Tosefta, which it was written right after the Mishnah in the 3rd century or in the 200s, it gives us a scenario. There was a Jew who is traveling by boat. Now in those days, when they would travel by boat, the boats moved with oarsmen, right? The oarsmen moved boats. They moved very, very slowly. So a boat trip across the Mediterranean, for example, say from Israel to Spain, or you want to take a boat trip from Israel to India, where they traded also, right? Could be a couple month trip. So you're going to be on the boat over Passover. Now, when you're on the boat, you take all your provisions for the entire trip with you. Now, let's say they're going to be on the boat over Passover. So if you're on the boat over Passover, then you can't have any chametz on Passover. You get rid of all your chametz before Passover. You still have another 2 months till you get to port. What are you going to eat for the next 2 months? Are you going to eat matzah for 2 months after Passover? So the Tosefta says that you have a simple solution, which is that before Passover, the Jew can take all of his chametz that he has stored to eat after Passover, and he can sell it to a non-Jewish fellow traveler. And give it to the non-Jew. The non-Jew now has all his chametz. He has the money. And then after Passover, he can go back to the non-Jew, offer to purchase it back from him, and get his chametz back. And that way, he did not own the chametz over Passover. The non-Jew, only a Jew is commanded not to own chametz on Passover. A non-Jew has no such commandment. They're not commanded not to own chametz on Passover. So by selling the chametz to the Jew avoids the prohibition. And they also remember, not only are they avoiding the prohibition of not owning chametz on Passover, also any chametz that a Jew does own on Passover cannot be eaten after Passover. But because this chametz was owned by a non-Jew over Passover, it now can be eaten after Passover. So the Jews give the chametz to the non-Jew. The non-Jew gave them the money. After Passover, the Jew goes and buys back his chametz. So this was the original system. This is what they did. This is what the Tosefta describes. And this is described by many, many, many other sources. It doesn't seem to have been that common. But when someone needed to sell their chametz, that's what they did. They gave all their chametz to the non-Jew. The non-Jew paid them for it. And then after Passover, if they wanted to, they purchased it back from the non-Jew. When would someone have done such a thing? Probably when they were traveling. Whether traveling in a caravan across, large uninhabited areas, or traveling on a boat. I mean, if you're at home, then you could just bake bread the day after Passover, right? There's no need to hold your chametz till later. So it was probably mostly done for travelers. It's unlikely that there were too many other scenarios in which this kind of thing was done. Most people didn't do this. Remember, they didn't have preservatives in their bread. So, and they didn't have freezers to freeze their bread. So they baked fresh bread till fairly recently, till 100 years ago. Everyone baked fresh bread every single day. That's what you did. You woke up in the morning, you baked your bread. Because otherwise, if you didn't break your bread that morning, you didn't have bread. Bread from the previous day would already be somewhat stale. They didn't even have plastic bags, Ziploc bags to put it in. So your bread would already be somewhat stale, even if maybe you wrapped it in paper or something. After 2 days, it's not edible anymore. It's totally stale, right? There's no preservatives in it. So people really just did this. They would use stale bread when they did travel long journeys. What did they do? They ate stale bread. They would maybe dry out their bread into crackers. so that it was kind of more of a cracker, so it was easier to eat, make it thin so you could break it and tear it or bite into it. Or sometimes they would soften it with dips. But that when they would travel, they would have stale bread. But normally they would have, you know, fresh bread every day. There was no need normally to sell your chametz. It was only done really by travelers. So this continued from when the Tosefta was written in the 300s and continued till around the 16th century. So for probably 1,200-1,300 years. In the 16th century, they came up with this amazing new invention. It wasn't actually a new invention, but it became commercialized. This new thing called vodka. Vodka was the first form of spirits. It was actually developed around the same time as whiskey was developed in Britain. But while whiskey remained in the British Isles mostly, vodka was used all over Europe. And these were essentially strong alcohols, better than beer, which they of course had for a very, very long time, better than beer, cheap, much, much cheaper and easier to make than wine. And it was a great thing. Why should you drink wine and beer if you can drink vodka? So vodka became the new drink in Europe started in the early 1500s, 16th century. So commercial vodka, from when it appears in Europe, it spreads very, very, very quickly. Everybody drinks it. Everyone's a big fan of it. It becomes very, very, very popular. So now Jews had been in the wine business and other spirits. They had other spirits like liqueurs and date wines and things like that for thousands of years. But Jews who had been in the alcohol business, of what it had been, mostly wine, for thousands of years. It was a very Jewish business throughout history. Jews dominated the business in Europe throughout at least the last 1,000 years or more, and dominated the business in other places even before that. So, of course, Jews moved into the vodka business. And so many Jews opened vodka distilleries, and they dominated the business in Europe for a very long time. And so Jews owned distilleries. Many Jews had distilleries. Many Jews were traders in that they would purchase barrels of vodka from distilleries and sell them to various taverns and towns and different places. And many Jews were tavern owners. Today they call it a bar, right? They would own bars where they would actually sell it to the customers. They would either sell directly bottles of vodka, or they would sell drinks, so people would come in for a drink. But they owned, many, many Jews owned taverns. So, and it became a really, really big, big business. There was a problem, however. Vodka is mostly made from wheat. It's mostly made from wheat, barley. It's made from grains, mostly. And it could be made from potatoes, but it was largely made from wheat. It's the easiest way to make it. Which would mean that vodka is, if it's made from wheat, it's chametz. And so, now, these Jewish vodka makers, distributors, sellers, right, store owners, they could not own their vodka over Passover. That is prohibited. You cannot own your vodka on Passover. And so, and if you do own it on Passover, it's forbidden for any Jew to use it, to eat it, to drink it, because it becomes chametz shavar alav ha-pesach, chametz owned by a non-Jew over Passover. Problem is that unlike the food you have stored for the next few weeks when you're traveling on the boat, where you could just hand the non-Jew and the non-Jew gives you cash, if you own a distillery, how do you hand all the vodka to the non-Jew? You can't pick it up, right? Or if you own a warehouse, or even a tavern with a bunch of barrels of it, how do you hand it, sell it to the non-Jew? It's also very expensive. Which person has money to purchase an entire distillery, or a warehouse of vodka, or even the tavern's storehouse or a storage room of vodka? Who has the money to purchase that? So they had to figure out a workaround. And the rabbis did, of course, figured out a workaround. And the first one who speaks about this is Rabbi Yoel Sirkis in his book Bayit Chadash, or Bach as it's known. And he's known as the Bach, that's an acronym for the name of his book. And he lived late 16th century, that's the end of the 1500s. And he writes that what they do is they can sell it to a non-Jew as is, sell the vodka where it is to a non-Jew, and rent the room where it is to the non-Jew. So then you don't actually have to give it to the non-Jew, you just rent the distillery, or the storage house, or the storage room in the tavern, rent it to the non-Jew for the duration of Passover, sell all of the barrels where they are, and they're in his possession, they're in his room, or in his distillery, because you've rented it for the rented the real estate to the non-Jew over Passover. Now the non-Jew doesn't have money to pay for it, to purchase an entire distillery. So what you do is, they would have the non-Jew give a down, put down a down payment for the amount of the sale, with a commitment to come up with the rest of the money within a certain time. You can make a sale with a down payment, finalize the sale, and the sale is final. It's already been sold, but you still need to come up with the money. We often sell things like that, right? Where you get a 30-day or whatever, 60 days to come up with the money, or retroactively the sale is canceled. So usually, and then the Jew comes after Passover and then can purchase it back for the same agreed upon price. Usually the Jew would give a little bit of a higher price than the original sale price, and that way the non-Jew makes money on the whole deal, so that earns their cooperation. They know they're going to make money from it. And so this became the way to do it. This is the way Jews would sell their chametz. Again, mostly the people here selling their chametz were mostly people in the vodka business, in the alcohol business, which was many, many Jews were in this alcohol business. It was a business dominated by Jews all across Europe, from really in Central Europe, in Eastern Europe, even later in Western Europe. It was a business dominated by Jews. So there were Jews that needed to do this. Now, many Jews struggled, and we know that by the 17th century, 1600s, mid-1600s, this was widely done. And so, now many Jews struggled to write their own contracts. So what they actually started doing is they would print standard contracts, because it's something everyone's doing. So they would print standard contracts. You could just copy it. You just hand copy it. And you know you get the exact wording, correct wording of how to write it correctly. Just fill in the names, location, amount, right? And there's kind of a space to fill in different things. I guess the original LegalZoom, right? You have kind of the standard contracts and you just fill it out. So a template for the contracts. In fact, in many 17th and 18th century Haggadahs, they would even, in the Haggadah, they would print the wording for the template of the sale of the of your one's chametz. If one wanted to sell it to a non-Jew, it was just a convenient place to put it where people could easily find it when they needed it. Yes, then. Pick up the entire distillery?
Why do you have to sell it?
Or why can't you gift it?
No, yeah, why can't you just ask them to hold it for you?
Well, you can't lend it, because if you lend it, you still own it.
Ask them to hold it for you.
You can gift it to them.
Whatever.
So the problem is, that's an excellent question.
Wouldn't it be a lot
easier? Excellent question. So you cannot lend it to a non-Jew. If you lend it, you still own it. You can, in theory, gift it, and in fact, the Tosefta we mentioned earlier raises that possibility, that instead of selling you the fellow on the boat, instead of selling their chametz to the non-Jew, just gift it to the non-Jew. And in theory, they can. The problem is that in this new system, where it's really just a contractual thing, but nothing's actually changing hands, right? Because the distillery is sitting exactly where it always stood, and the warehouse is sitting exactly where it always sat. Right, nothing's moving. So in such a thing, if I gift it to you and then you gift it back to me, it doesn't sound like a legitimate contract. So therefore, we do an actual legal sale. A sale is a binding thing. It's much stronger than just a gift.
Purpose not to have it in your house.
Not to own it. Very clear. It's not. It's allowed to be in your house if it belongs to a non-Jew. You're not allowed to own it. You're not allowed to own it. If you own it and it's in the non-Jew's house, you still have a problem. You're not allowed to own it. That's the issue. Yes, Susan?
In a non-kosher house, is there a prohibition of not eating matzah before, like within 30 days of...
There is a prohibition not to eat matzah on the day before Passover, and a custom by some not to eat matzah in the 30 days before Passover. But that's not directly relevant to this.
Okay. I have a question. Have you ever heard...
Let's continue, and I'll take questions. So now, the thing with this contract that was drawn up is, it must be a legal contract, which is why it must be something that's legally binding. And it must be binding in two systems of law. It must be binding both under Jewish law, so that Jewishly you don't own it, as well as under the law of the land. Because if the government won't recognize the sale, then of what value is the sale, right? It's not a real sale if the government won't recognize it, if the courts won't recognize it. And so in the 18th century, the Alter Rebbe, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who we've done a class about, and was a great Torah scholar, he raised an issue with the contract that people were using, which is as follows. If you sell your distillery or your warehouse or your storeroom in your tavern to a non-Jew, and with all your vodka there, and this thing is worth thousands, tens of thousands of whatever currency they had, it's worth a very large amount of money, and the non-Jew just puts down a deposit with a commitment to pay the rest. The law is, at least not the Jewish law, if you know that they're never going to be able to come up with the money, the sale is not valid. Because they're not going to come up with the money. What sort of sale is that? So he argued, they're never going to be able to come up with that kind of money. They don't have this kind of money. What kind of sale is that? That's not a valid sale. So he came up with a workaround. And he said as follows. The solution is, what you can do is get another Jew to guarantee the sale. You can sell something and you can get someone else to then guarantee, or you could, let's say you borrow money and then you get a guarantor to guarantee that if the borrower can't pay, the guarantor will pay. You could do the same thing in a sale where the buyer says, I'm going to put down a deposit now, I owe you the rest, and then you have a guarantor. If the buyer doesn't come back with the money, then the guarantor can pay the money, right? What you can even do, a co-signer, right? What you can even do is, you can have a co-signer that in Hebrew we call it an Arif Kablan, a co-signer who has first responsibility. So normally the guarantor or the co-signer is the backup. If the person who's buying it cannot come up with the money, you go to the backup, to the guarantor. But you can also do it the other way, where you first go to the guarantor for the money, you don't even bother going to the original buyer, and then the guarantor has to go and claim their money that the buyer owes them directly. They could go and sue the buyer, because right, the guarantor who guaranteed the money still can go claim the money, right? If you guarantee a loan and you end up having to pay up for the borrower who fails to pay up their loan, right, the guarantor can still go sue the borrower for the money to get the money back. So his suggestion was, have another Jew serve as this guarantor. And a first party guarantor, in other words, whom the seller can come initially to back to for the money, for the full value of whatever you are selling. And then, even if this second person, this Jew, doesn't really have the money to pay for an entire distillery, but he doesn't want his fellow Jew to own chametz over Passover. So he's going to find a way to raise the money, including going back to the Jew himself who sold the chametz and asking him for the money, right? So therefore, because he'll be determined to ensure that the sale is valid, therefore such a sale then, even if the money is going to be hard to find, the sale therefore would be valid. These sales also must be valid based on the legal code of the land, under the local laws. So it must be written in a way that it's valid under the local laws. One issue that was raised by the Chtam Sofer, we did a class about him a few months ago, Rav Moshe Sofer in the early 19th century. He lived in in today's Slovakia, but it was then the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, the Austrian Empire. An issue raised by him was, well, if this is a valid legal sale, then it needs to be reported to the government and you need to pay sales tax.
Surprise,
right? So in the Austrian Empire, they actually got a government rule passed that for those selling chametz for Passover, that they're then going to buy back, they are exempt from sales tax. Luckily, here, we don't really have that issue because the law, at least in California, and I believe in every state that has sales tax, is that if you sell something, you are technically required to pay sale. The seller is required under California state law to pay sales tax, even if you sell something privately, by the way. If you sell something just to, you know, your neighbor, your friend, you are legally obliged to pay to report it and pay sales tax. But if you offer a refund, in other words, if they give it back to you and you give them back the money, then you are not obligated to pay sales tax. When we sell the chametz before Passover, we later end up buying it back from the non-Jew after Passover, right? So legally, we're not actually required to pay sales tax, but it is a legal sale, right? If the non-Jew chooses not to sell it back, then we got to worry about sales tax. So for the 17th and 18th centuries, people who were selling their chametz were mostly alcohol distillery owners, dealers, tavern owners, people involved in the alcohol business in some way or another, and the chametz they were selling was vodka. It was really only now people generally sold the chametz by themselves. They had, as we said, templates, and what they would generally do is they would go to the local rabbi, they would bring a non-Jewish friend, and the local rabbi would fill out the contract for them, make sure it's all legal, finalize it for them, because, you know, not everyone's a lawyer or a scholar and knows how to do it properly. And whoever, all the dealers in town, all the people in the alcohol business would sell their chametz. By the early 19th century, the prices of vodka came down significantly, and it became much, much cheaper. And so people began to purchase their own private vodka. It wasn't just that you went to the tavern to buy vodka, right? But people had their own stashes of vodka. People would buy bottles and drink it themselves or drink it at parties. When it was very, in earlier years, when it was very expensive, people didn't buy it themselves. But as the prices went down with, you know, commercialization and production increase, people were able to buy their own bottles. People had their own bottles of vodka at home. And so people had their own bottles. Now, they didn't want to get rid of it before Passover. They didn't want to have to drink it all or throw it out. So it was still pricey. And so people who were not involved in the alcohol business also began to sell their chametz before Passover to a non-Jew. And it soon became that there were way too many people in the average town selling their chametz for the rabbi to sit with each one and to go through a sale for each one. So gradually, in the early 19th century, rabbis came up with another solution, which is that rather than having each person sell their chametz to a non-Jew, what they did is every person would basically sign a form, that a document that appointed the rabbi as their agent to sell their chametz on their behalf. And they would sign this form, and they would give it to the rabbi, and then the rabbi would then call in a non-Jew, and he would sell all, on behalf of all the various people in the community who want to sell their chametz, he would sell their chametz to the non-Jew. So this was already done, this has been done for about 200 years since people began to have their own chametz. This became an even bigger issue in the 20th century because with commercialization of food, but until the early 20th century, everyone baked their own bread or bought it in the bakery, fresh from the bakery every day. Commercialization of food allowed for, firstly, all sorts of new foods that maybe you can keep over time. Cereals, pasta, cookies, things that last for weeks, for months, for years. Don't need to throw all that out. It wasn't just bread anymore. In addition, by mid-1920s, 1930s, people began to get freezers. They could freeze bread, freeze foods that are chametz. And so now everyone has chametz in their pantry, and you're not going to eat it all before Passover, so everyone needs to sell their chametz. So today, the way we do it, I'll soon give you some details of exactly how it's done, is that everyone in the community therefore signs the document making the rabbi their agent to sell their chametz, and the rabbi sells the chametz of the whole community to a non-Jew on behalf of the entire community. So how practically is this done? So the rabbi creates a form that essentially says that I, the undersigned, give the rabbi the power, the agency, to sell my chametz on my behalf. And in the days and weeks before Passover, the rabbi distributes this form to the community. People fill in this document with their names, and they write in the location where the chametz is going to be, right, the address of exactly where it is. They sign it to make it legally binding, and then they give it to the rabbi. Today, this can also be done online, using online forms, because legally, the courts have widely ruled that hitting a submit button after hitting the I agree to all the above and hitting submit is a legally binding contract, and that's the law today. So it's a legally binding contract. You can do it, or you can, and it's not a very company, it's just an agency. You're just not actually selling anything. You're just giving the rabbi agency. You can do it online as well. Then the rabbi collects all of these forms together, puts them in a file, and on a folder. On the day before Passover, in late morning, before that last hour before midday, the rabbi meets with the non-Jew and a second Jew who will be the guarantor. And they use a pre-drafted document that's usually written out in advance that essentially says that they are selling, the rabbi is selling the non-Jew all the chametz belonging to all the members of the community who filled out the forms in this folder and found in all the locations written down on the forms in this folder. The agreement says that the non-Jew agrees to pay fair market value for all the chametz, whatever fair market value can realistically be sold for. He agrees to pay fair market value minus a stipulated amount, usually a couple hundred dollars or something, fair market value minus that amount. And that amount, which is essentially if he would then keep it and then sell it on the market of whatever it's worth, right? Your old pasta might not be worth very much, but he sells it on the market, whatever it's worth, because he purchased it for fair market value minus a few hundred dollars. If he then sells it at fair market value, he's made a few hundred dollars, right? So that's his profit. So it makes it worth it for him, right? So the agreement also requires the non-Jew to give a token deposit, usually a few dollars, $10, $20, immediately. And the rest is going to be due on the day after Passover. So you have essentially, this is the day before Passover. Passover is 8 days. You have 9 days the non-Jew has 9 days to pay back to pay up the rest of the value. To evaluate it, figure out how much it's all worth, and then pay up the rest. The agreement also stipulates that the non-Jew is going to rent all of these locations that the chametz is in. In other words, any pantry or freezer or any place that has been set aside for the chametz in these locations, that the non-Jew is going to rent them until the day after Passover for a token amount, $20. That's fine. They can rent it for a small amount. And the agreement also allows the non-Jew to walk into any location stipulated on these documents. So they can walk into your house, they have legal right to find the chametz, and they will be pointed to where your chametz is, and they can empty it out, if they choose to, over Passover. They have that legal right, right? So you're giving them access, right? You have to give them legal access to the chametz. The agreement further says that in event that the non-Jew fails to come up with the money, or if the people who are selling their chametz can collect the full amount, or can even to start with, go to the Jew serving as a guarantor to collect the full value of the chametz once on the deadline, or once the deadline is passed, the day after Passover. Document also stipulates that if the non-Jew is unable or unwilling to come up with the rest of the money, then the sellers can choose to purchase back their chametz before the stipulated date, the day after Passover. So the non-Jew, the rabbi, and the guarantor then all sign the document. They shake hands, finalizing the agreement, they lift up a handkerchief, which is the way you finalize an agreement in Jewish traditions. So under Jewish law, when we finalize something, the common thing that you do is you shake hands, you sign on it, but under Jewish law, you lift up a handkerchief. Each side lifts up a handkerchief. It's a way of finalizing an agreement. And then each participant is given a copy of the document, and the non-Jew is given the file with the folder with all the names of people selling chametz and all the places where the chametz will be. Now, all that chametz in the community belongs to him, and the Jews no longer own the chametz over Passover. Then after Passover, the rabbi and the non-Jew meet again. The rabbi offers to purchase back the chametz from the non-Jew at its full value. Now remember, originally the non-Jew purchased it at its full value minus $100 or a few hundred dollars. Now, the rabbi is purchasing it back at full value, which means that he has to give the deposit back, the $20 deposit back to the non-Jew. He also has to give him that $100 that, because he's selling it, he's basically buying back for $100 more. He gives it to the non-Jew, and that's his profit. And now the people in the community own their chametz once again, and it didn't belong to Jews over Passover, and they are now able to eat it. So today, virtually every Jew who wants to avoid owning chametz on Passover has some chametz somewhere, whether in beer or whiskey, or whiskey is also made from grain, or vodka, or some other alcohols, or just cakes in the freezer, or pasta, or cereals, or any other thing that may be chametz, and they don't want to throw it out, and so therefore the standard is that everyone signs a document delegating the rabbi, giving the rabbi the power, the agency, to sell their chametz on their behalf. Now the Rebbe is encouraged that we should always help Jews do as many mitzvahs as possible. Even if they're not doing one mitzvah, that's not an excuse not to do other mitzvahs. And therefore the Rebbe said, this mitzvah of not owning chametz on Passover is super easy. Even a Jew who does not stop eating chametz on Passover, they don't observe Passover for whatever reason, and they continue to eat chametz on Passover, let alone try to remove all chametz from their possession and not own chametz on Passover, even such a Jew who is transgressing the prohibition of not eating chametz on Passover, and perhaps not even making a Seder and not eating matzah, but even so, they can easily avoid the prohibition of owning chametz on Passover and avoid the prohibition of eating chametz after Passover that was owned by a Jew on Passover by just signing a simple document. It's an easy thing to do. And the Rebbe strongly believed that even if a Jew is not doing one mitzvah, maybe they're eating chametz on Passover, they should still be encouraged to do other mitzvahs. At least they shouldn't own that chametz that they're eating. At least they're fulfilling another mitzvah. Removing all chametz, stopping to eat chametz on Passover, is not easy for everyone. It could be challenging for some people. They don't do it. They're not careful about it. They can't go without their daily muffin or whatever they have every morning, right? Their daily bagel. So some people might find it very hard. But signing a delegation document that you delegate the rabbi to sell your chametz and having him sell it for you is easy. It takes about 20 seconds. And with that, you've fulfilled a mitzvah. And so therefore the Rebbe encouraged that we should get every single Jew, no matter their observance, no matter whether they observe Passover, no matter whether they eat chametz or don't eat chametz on Passover, we should encourage every single Jew to fill out a form delegating the rabbi the power of selling their chametz on Passover. It can be done very easily. And just to conclude, the Baal Shem Tov taught that when we avoid chametz on Passover, God then helps us avoid sin or doing bad a whole year round. So it's a very powerful thing. And so we should, at least we should definitely try to avoid eating chametz on Passover, but also we should take that 20 seconds or less than 60 seconds it takes to fill out one of these forms. And any Jew you know, you should get them to fill out the form as well.